The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. You're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It is Love Donegal Day, and we are going to be focusing on that a little bit throughout the programme. Our friend of the show on Highland Radio, of course, Kevin Fury, is out in the west of the county in one of my favourite parts of Donegal. He's going to be joining us after 10. And as I say, we're going to give away a couple of shirts, a couple of 9 till noon show mugs if you want to tell us what you love about Donegal or why you want to visit here, maybe if you're listening or return here if you're listening from outside the county. How do you get involved in the conversation and to send us the reasons as to why you love Donegal? 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. If you're watching on social media, on our YouTube channel Highland Radio Ireland, feel free to leave your comments there. It's not about which one is best, it's not a competition as such. We'll just throw all the names into a hat and draw two out, and two lucky winners will win a lovely Highland shirt and a 9 till noon show mug. And don't forget, if you are on social media, share your pictures or your stories of Highland Radio, be it on Threads or X or Facebook or wherever you are, and use the hashtag Love Donegal and do your bit, because often, you know, what can we do to try and help each other and help the area? Do your bit to spread the love and the message of Love Donegal. It really is a relatively young initiative, but it has proved hugely successful and hugely beneficial in spreading the word about Donegal. So you can imagine the beautiful scenery that sometimes we take for granted that is just outside our window. Take a picture of it, put it up on social media, Instagram as well, or wherever it might be, hashtag Love Donegal, and then you get Love Donegal trending and people all around the world see it. It's simple, but it's really effective. And as I say, we will be talking about that a little later on. But as I say, feel free to send in what you love about the county, maybe even some pictures if you want. I can throw them up for the live stream as well as sharing them on our social medias. It's a busy morning for newspapers, obviously, because it is a Thursday. And we'll start with the Tyrconnell Tribune this morning. The EU's decision to impose new derogation cuts on Ireland from January is seen by many farmers as the first signal that the battle on the nitrates directive has already been lost, and at best, it can only be construed as the very worst of news. IFA President Tim Cullinan said farmers are of the view that the derogation suits the government agenda as it reduces cow numbers by the back door. As staunch members and defenders of the EU mandate, the Irish government might, if they had any balls, follow the Germans, who've decided to block the final approval of EU legislation to ban the sale of all except electric cars from 2035. All Germany wants is to protect their precious car industry and stuff everyone else. So that's, in other words, another derogation. An example that the Germans are using theirs in relation to cars, so why should we be ashamed of ours in relation to the rearing of cattle? The Finn Valley Voice this morning. Householders affected by the Ballymofaith Stranorlar 10T priority route have this week received letters updating the state of the project. The letters issued by DCC and the RPS /BT indicates that Phase 4 government approval and the publication of compulsory purchase and environmental impact documents is about to begin, a stage at which many projects have come to grief. More on the front of and inside that paper today. The Donegal News this morning. Around 380 staff in Donegal County Council are taking industrial action as part of an ongoing dispute to achieve job evaluation in the sector. As part of the industrial dispute, there's a ban on council workers engaging in all non-statutory political representation, verbal, email and written, with councillors, senators, TDs, including ministers and MEPs. The industrial action, which is being overseen by trade union Forsa, began on Monday. And as we heard from Forsa, they have effectively a mandate up to and including full strike action. So this is the first volley, and it will escalate if they don't get what they want. The Donegal Democrat this morning. A man rescued from a sea cave off Owy Island on Sunday evening has told of his living nightmare. Malachy Doyle, who lives at Critch Island, went for a wee trip to Owey Island in his kayak on quiet waters, but he told how he feared for his life after encountering difficulty in a sea cave amid choppy waters. Such was the perilous nature of the situation. The 69-year-old writer says that only for a Ziploc bag to keep his phone dry, he would still be there on that tiny ledge frozen solid. At around 3 p.m, Malachy was able to raise the alarm. His difficulty began when, having decided against entering the cave due to the churning sea inside, a freak wave hit him from behind, overturning the vessel and coping him into the water. Man and boat hurled deep into a cave. The Derry news this morning: crippling Airbnbism impacting on Lawrence Hill residents, creeping Airbnbism. A residents' association is determined to maintain the community family balance of one of Derry's oldest residential streets in the face of creeping Airbnbism. Speaking to Derry News, a spokesperson for Lawrence Hill Residents Association said families in the street had been increasingly forced to negotiate the challenges presented by living alongside a highly transient population. Back to the Nationals now, and RTE all over the papers today. Of course, a group of them were back before an Oireachtas committee to answer further questions. I watched some of it. It amazes me that they should know what questions are coming but not have the answers to. Like, for instance, one perfect example would be this private members club in London. They had a... for reasons which I don't really buy, but they had a membership to this exclusive club in London. And one of the first questions was, do you still have that membership? No one knew. What, do we have it? I don't know. Do we? Well, we haven't paid the invoice. Yeah, but are we still members? I don't know. Do you know? Crazy stuff. You know, you would have known that was coming up again. Why did they not have the answer to that? But anyway, that's just one example. With all the brains that were there, you would think they would have the basics covered, but they didn't. But the Irish Independent tells us that a cull of staff through targeted and voluntary redundancy, a potential sale of Montrose and reducing programming are all part of brutal cost-cutting plans at RTE. Workers at the national broadcaster have been put on alert about a wide range of slimming down of the organisation, including a potential sale of assets and less investment in digital. The sale of 2FM's is also... the sale of 2FM is also expected to be put into the equation, according to senior sources at the station, desperately seeking to restructure and raise funding. I don't think the public, in withholding their licence fee, necessarily want regular workers on, you know, 25, 30, whatever they're on, to be sacked or what have you, or to be let go. I think what the public want, they want to see those who are making an absolute mint whilst preaching to us to get reasonable wages. And for other measures to be taken. But hitting staff right across the board, I'm not sure that's exactly what the public want. Selling 2FM makes perfect sense. It's not public service broadcasting, and it competes with... I mean, this morning on The Breakfast Show, they have the ability to give away €10,000. Just give it away like that there, if they want to, through competitions. They're very well resourced to compete with iRadio, FM 104 and all the rest. That's not really fair. RTE, perhaps you can argue more strongly, has a public service remit. 2FM, it doesn't. It's in a commercial. It's a commercial radio station in a commercial market, and really doesn't need our taxpayers' money going to €10,000 competitions, I would argue. But anyway, the sale or part of all of RTE's Montrose campus, worth an estimated £500 million, is now flagged, and valuations are currently being conducted on the site. RTE bosses have to come up with a plan of cutbacks in the next month to avail of a bailout in the budget and get reform of the licence fee. And again, you know, don't send Keith Duffy over to get his to look at people getting their teeth done in Turkey. Spend that on the iPlayer. You know what I mean? Buy in that programme from ITV2. It's nonsense anyway. That again, that's just a little simple thing that perhaps they could do that the public might go, all right, okay, maybe I might consider paying my licence again. The national broadcaster is already looking for $35 million and projecting a further $21 million shortfall from people not paying their television licence. The government will not be giving RTE the full amount requested. So what would you, genuinely, what would you like to see? And not, we can't just say, oh, we'll scrap it or get rid of it, but what would be a good first step for RTE where you might consider, if you would consider, so we're talking hypothetically here, paying your TV licence again? Like, what would be enough? What is the thing that bothers you the most that you would like to see changed, or that you might say, right, well, if you're doing that, I can meet you halfway. Please let us know. 086 60 25000, WhatsApp and text, or call us on 07491 25000. The Irish Times tells us that Garda Commissioner Drew Harris has described as a kick in the teeth and a heavy blow the vote by rank and file Gardaí to express no confidence in him by a majority of 99%, but he's insisted he'll not resign. He's got the backing of the Justice Minister. He's got the backing of the government, but he doesn't have the backing of regular Gardaí. 99%, effectively all Gardaí, have no faith in their boss. It's hard to believe that can be ignored, isn't it? We're going to be speaking to the GRA a little later on. But it is hard to believe how someone can continue on in their position. And I'm not suggesting you should go or not. But how could you continue on in that position when 99% of the people that work under you have no faith in you? Well, he believed the vote by members of the Garda Representative Association was deliberately personalised. Minister for Justice Helen McEntee echoed that view, saying Mr Harris had her and the government's full support. She said the GRA must now get back around the table for talks on new Garda rosters, but said the rostering row was an internal Garda matter that she could not intervene in. The policing authority, which recruits senior Gardaí officers and is the force's main watchdog agency, also issued a statement of full and unwavering confidence in Mr Harris. The leadership team of the Garda, which is comprised of its most senior officers and civilian managers, issued a statement to all Gardaí members saying it had full confidence in Mr Harris. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and motorists could face additional penalties for speeding through at risk zones, such as for roadworks and schools, a new report to the government has outlined. The report, which sets out the proposed speed limits, was published yesterday. Among a range of proposals, the report said higher penalties should apply for at-risk routes, such as for roadworks, schools and shared-use zones. A spokesperson for the government confirmed that it intends to seek legislation passed to reduce speed limits by the end of March next year, after which work would commence with local authorities to implement the reduced speeds. Now, as I say, not all roads will have their speeds reduced. The good roads presumably will retain their current speed limits. But the report said that its recommendation should be implemented within 2 years. So you could see tougher penalties in certain areas. On to the Irish Farmers Journal now, and the Agri-Climate Rural Environment Scheme will reopen for new applications in mid-October. However, the exact number of farmers to be accepted will depend on the government's purse strings. Minister for Agriculture Charlie McConlogue does not yet know what budget he'll have to cater for farmers applying to the scheme. That's something that will be part of them in the mix now. In terms of engagement with Minister for Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue, McConlogue said ahead of crunch talks about Budget 2024. Mary Lou McDonald has been going through a medical situation which required an operation, and she released a video on social media to say she's back at work as leader of Sinn Féin, this after a summer operation. The Dublin TD, who boxes in her spare time, is fighting fit and has posted a video on Twitter to announce her comeback. In the video, she prioritises housing as the one area where Sinn Féin will concentrate on if the people elect them to lead after the next general election. Miss McDonald warned Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that Sinn Féin are now ready to lead. She said, as some of you know, I had an operation in June and I've been recovering over the last number of weeks. And then she went on to say that she is now fully recovered and was sort of seeking to rally the troops. I'll get to that story in a moment. Firstly, we'll go to the Irish Sun. And the frantic mother of a teenaged girl who went missing on a family trip to Disneyland Paris has declared, "I just want her home." Mum, Magdalene Palm, said it's been hell since Amber Victoria vanished on August 7th, telling the paper, "No one has heard from my baby in a month." The 17-year-old disappeared on the last day of her holiday with Mum, Magdalene, 39, Dad, Dennis, 44, and 9-year-old brother, Gino. Amber snuck away from Disney's Hotel Santa Fe in France as her family slept at 3 a.m. before meeting a young man at a nearby petrol station. After reporting her missing to French police, CCTV was retrieved showing the girl being driven away from the garage by the man whom I believe she met online, but she's missing now since August 7th, and that family, who are now Irish-based, are up to high dough of fear of their daughter's safety. Now, this is the story that's a wee bit a strange one. The US tourist, as you would know, do you remember it started all the big hoo-ha around Dublin? He was assaulted and severely injured and spent quite a bit of time in hospital. He's on the road to recovery and he's back home. But a GoFundMe page was started and his two sons came over to see how their dad was, to check on him. But anyway, there's a bit of a row about a GoFundMe account that was set up. Assault victim Stephen Termini's son has denied his father's claim that he stole funds raised by him or for him by the public. The US tourist, who has recovered from a brutal attack in Dublin in July, said he hadn't seen a cent of the €120,000 raised by Mike Rizzuto and on the website GoFundMe. Mr. Termetti, who is back in his hometown of Buffalo, New York, said, "That GoFundMe my son set up, he stole all that money. He didn't give me any of that money. My heart's broken. He won't answer my calls. He won't call me back. I'm planning to file a complaint of fraud with GoFundMe. I'm going to get GoFundMe to give all those people their money back, and then I'm going to hopefully set up one for myself. I can't believe he did that. In my heart, I was so thankful for what the people did, and I was going to use that to buy a house and just be where I wanted to be in Ireland. When I found out what happened, I was devastated. Even after all that I've gone through, I thought I had a reward for dealing with that, and just wanted to buy, not a mansion or anything, but a cosy little place. When I found out it was, no, you're not getting that, I was like, wow." And now the son's saying, "Well, we thought the money was for us to travel over there and pay our bills and pay our accommodation, and if Dad needed care in the future, you know, we'd look after him. But Dad's fine, and the money's ours, and that money's yours." I don't know if anyone listening to this show donated to it. But anyway, the family are rowing over that 120,000. I mean, that's a lot of money, €120,000. I think it's going to make people think twice about donating to such things. There does need to be a little bit more accountability on some of the monies raised. There's no doubt about that. Right, OK. That was a run through Thursday's newspapers. Just to remind you, it is Love Donegal Day. Take your pictures, send your messages about Donegal, what you love about it. Use the hashtag Love Donegal across all your social media, and you'll be doing great things to get the county trending and to spread the love around the world. We're giving away a lovely mug and Highland tea set for a couple of you out there today. All we want you to do is just message us and tell us why you love Donegal. What is it about Love Donegal? What part of Donegal do you love? And you can also comment on our social media and we'll enter you in that competition as well. Now, the fallout continues from the reduction in the nitrates derogation on the Irish farming sector, and it's covered extensively, as you can imagine, in this morning's Farmers Journal. So we invited Aidan Brennan, dairy editor, on just to see where we're at and where we are, I suppose, in terms of that fallout. Good morning, Aidan.
Good morning, Greg.
There's no doubt, and perhaps it shouldn't have come as a surprise, there's no doubt that farmers are very, very angry about this and angry with the Agriculture Minister. From your perspective, do you want to give us an outline of how we come to this point?
Yeah, so basically every farm animal in the country has got an organic nitrogen excretion rate. And for dairy cows, that ranges between 80 and 106 kilograms. And across the European Union, the maximum stocking rate you're allowed to have is 170 kilograms per hectare. But in Ireland and a number of other EU countries, we've been given permission to increase that up to a maximum of 250 kilograms. Based on the, you know, grass growing, the long grass growing season, the high nitrogen uptake of grass. So we've been given this exemption, or derogation as it's known as, and that's allowed farmers to stock the farm higher. But also, and it's important to say that permission or that derogation is hinged on the fact that water quality does not deteriorate as a result of getting that derogation. But the European Commission have come back now to say that Ireland's derogation has been reduced from 250 to 220 kilograms. And that has farmers up in arms, because farmers that are stocked greater than 220 kilograms now have to reduce their stocking rate or find extra land, all of which are very unpalatable. Plus, what's really angering farmers is that Teagasc and other independent research centres and organisations are saying that reducing this derogation won't actually improve water quality. Mm-hmm. So that's really why farmers are so angry at the moment.
We're not really sure, are we, as to the breakdown as of the polluters? I mean, we've had an awful polluting incident in Donegal in the last couple of days. Thousands of fish killed. Nothing to do with farming, but really, do we have a system of monitoring our water pollution that can sort of distinguish between, I don't know, commercial, maybe state-owned versus agricultural pollution?
Well, the EPA, who monitor water quality, do say that they can differentiate the different sources of pollution, and nitrogen pollution is largely to do with agriculture, mm-hmm. and that's a fact. But it's large, you know, and there's different like impacts upon that, and one of the greatest impacts on nitrogen levels in water is actually the weather. And in the free-draining soils, you know, where nitrogen is a bigger issue, you can have no farming activity at all and you could still have elevated levels of nitrogen just because of the nature of soil type, weather. And nitrogen is a naturally occurring nutrient anyway. So you're going to get higher levels of nitrogen pollution no matter what happens. But I suppose the thing is, we need to reduce our nitrogen levels within the water, within the waterways and groundwater in Ireland. And farmers are doing that. And steps that are taken in the last year or so has been shown by Chagas to have a greater impact on reducing nitrogen losses than reducing the stocking rate. But the European Commission haven't given enough time for these measures to come in, for, you know, that are coming in to have the impact on water quality. So that's why farmers are also angry. But I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, farmers are willing to take on board the anything that's necessary to improve water quality. Once it doesn't, you know, take them out of business.
Well, they would argue that they would argue that they have actually been doing that, but not enough time has been given to see the fruits of their labour. So, you know, they're trying. They have been trying, particularly down the southwest, I think. And you know, they feel that they're being punished before, sort of, as I say, the fruits of that labour have been shown.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, what the farmers were calling for prior to this announcement was more time for the existing measures that are taking place in farms to have an impact on water quality. But, you know, that wasn't listened to by the European Commission. And I suppose there's a lot of blame now on the government and our own Minister McConnell for not listening to farmers well enough, not fighting the case of farmers at the European level. He'll argue back that he fought hard, that, you know, he negotiated as strong as he could, but the European Commission weren't for bending.
But on that point, that's pretty much what he said in his statement published afterwards, that they've made the decision and they're not going to change their mind. Is that it? Are we really that strongly dictated to by the EU, where we have to put our hands up and say, well, they've made that decision and those are the rules that we have to live by? I mean, it's not negotiation, that is it? That's I don't mean it in the strong words of dictatorship, but they're dictating to us.
Yeah, so I mean, that's the rules, you know, that's the legislation that Ireland signed up to, and it, you know, and that's the reality of it. But for me, the issue is that the horse is bolted in this case. What happened is that the European Commission came out with the terms and conditions of the derogation in March 2022, and the Irish government accepted them at that point. And that's where the mistake was made. They should have fought harder not to accept those terms back in March 2022. You know, at that stage, the Commission said, oh, if water quality doesn't improve between 2021 and 2022, we're not going to grant you the 250 again, and we're going to bring it back to 220. They accepted that then. And that's really flawed, because you shouldn't compare water quality in one year versus the next. Water quality should be compared as a trend over time. The EPA look at water quality over a minimum of 3 years. Yes, we have this huge economic impact on farmers. That's all dependent on just 1 year. And that's why, you know, farmers are angry with the government for accepting these, what they would say as flawed terms.
So what next? What do you think this means for Minister Charlie McConnell? Because The farming groups, at least the IFA, let's talk about them for certainty, they refused to meet Minister McConnell and then kind of met his boss along with him, which perhaps wasn't a great look. We had the head of the IFA on this programme, and whilst he wouldn't respond directly whether or not he fully supported the minister in his job, if you know what I mean. He says, look, we'll have to work with him. But he had an opportunity to say, yeah, no, we have confidence in him. He didn't say that. He didn't say he didn't have confidence in him either. So what does this mean, do you think, in relation to the relationship between the major farming groups, the farming community and the Minister for Agriculture?
Well, it's very poor at the moment. You have to accept that. There was a meeting then last week where the IFA decided that they weren't going to attend. ICMSA did attend that, and there was more issues there. Certainly, there's been a breakdown in a relationship between the Tim Cullinan and the IFA president and Minister McConnellogue. Look, it remains to be seen where that's going to end. There's a bit of politics at play here as well, of course, in the sense that the IFA need to be seen to be taking a very, proactive stance on this for their members. There's an IFA election coming up at the end of this year as well, of course. So there's a bit of politics at play. It's hard to know where it's going to end up, but at the end of the day, everyone will eventually come back to the table. That always happens in these things. And, you know, it has to happen because while nitrates is the issue at the moment, you know, another issue will present itself in the next few months where dialogue will be required.
Is the solution to this that the farmers are going to have to swallow this, obviously, because it seems to be a fait accompli, but the government, the way they might try and to appease farmers is to try and, however they might do so, compensate them for the gap between where they were and where they're going to be? More money?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there is a significant gap there, though, and I can't see the government funding that. I mean, in worst-case scenarios, there could be a loss of up to 30% in profitability for farmers that are affected by this nitrate derogation change. The real battleground really would be to retain the 220 at the next time that it doesn't go any lower, because it could potentially, and this is the threat the government are saying, that it could potentially be down to 170 kilos next time, which would be absolutely disastrous for the dairy industry. If funding is one option, it's going to be very difficult to adequately compensate farmers for the losses involved. There is another issue, of course, as well, in the sense that not all of the country could potentially be at the 220 kilogram mark. The EPA published a map showing the parts of the country where they suggest that the derogation should be reduced. So not all of Ireland is currently under that. It remains to be seen yet whether the government are going to impose a blanket ban, a blanket measure of 220, or will they have certain parts at 250 and more parts at 220. I suppose the IFA are saying that if some of the country is still at 250, that leaves the door open for more of the country in time, depending on water quality results, to come back up to 250, which would obviously be a good outcome to this fiasco.
Well, when will farmers know about that? Because that sounds really quite complicated and could be another controversial point. So when will we know any variance in that? Because, as I say, the reduction is just around the corner now.
Yeah, so the minister says he'll have the final map published in the next few weeks in consultation with industry stakeholders. So we're awaiting that in the next few weeks. But then farmers only have, as you say, a couple of months before this ban kicks in, or this reduction kicks in 2024. And we won't know, you know, the full outcomes. You know, there's certainly most of the country will be at 220. We know this for sure next January, and that's going to run for the next 2 years. Who knows what happens then in 2026?
All right, okay, but you would be confident that the minister's secure in his portfolio at the moment, that the relationships, the bridges can be rebuilt?
I think so. I can't see the minister falling on a sword over this issue. It seems he has the full backing of the government, both the Taoiseach and also the Taoiseach. I suppose the other thing to say is that, you know, I know that I speak to Highland Radio, but the nitrates is probably a greater issue in the southeast of the country, in the south of the country, as opposed to the northwest. So,
I think certainly in terms of scale, but I suppose it's also very relative as well. But I do understand exactly what you're saying, Aidan. Thank you.
There are pockets, of course, of Donegal that are going to be seriously affected by this also, you know, the more intensively farmed areas. So it is an issue.
All right, Aidan, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Much more on that and much more besides, of course, on the front of it inside the Farmers Journal, which is out today. That's Aidan Brennan, who is the dairy editor. Now, we were covering the controversy of the gates being put back in situ at on Greenin of Alia, so that people, once they'd made their way up to On Green On, into the entrance, they couldn't get into it because gates had been installed there. There's a big debate about it. Obviously, it restricts people seeing sunsets and sunrises now, but also there was concerns expressed that if people can get in anyway, and what you might see is people dangerously clambering over walls to get in there. And a lot of criticism of the OPW. We got in contact with the OPW for a response from them. So you may or may not be satisfied with what it has to say, but I'll read it for you. It reads as follows. The OPW recognises the importance of Green and Alia, not only as a heritage site, but also in its context as a prime tourism asset for Donegal. In keeping with our remit of preservation, protection and presentation of the national monuments in state care, OPW provides public access balance with the requirement to ensure the protection of the monument. The site on which Green and of Alia is located is in state ownership. The car park and adjacent enclosed ground is not in state ownership and has been maintained by Donegal County Council since it was opened in 1955. Supervision by a caretaker during the hours the Green and of Alia is open, supplemented with security assistance, is essential to both safeguarding the monument and ensuring the safety of visitors and OPW staff. The closing of the barrier at the foot of the access lane outside opening hours has been effective in reducing antisocial behaviour at and damage to the monument. This action is dependent on a security company attending the site at the closing of the barrier every day. So this is the barrier at the foot of access. So this is down at the car park, right? Or down just as you before you access up. And then it goes on to say, in light of the considerable cost to the state of the attendance of a security company and through ongoing engagement and mutual decision with Donegal County Council. So a lot of talk has been about, well, what's the OPW doing? Why is the OPW doing this? Apparently, they've made a mutual decision with Donegal County Council in regard to On Green On. It was decided to trial the 24-hour opening of the barrier. Okay. The pedestrian gate into the Cashel was reinstated. This had been stolen a number of years previously. This regime is designed to discourage easy access in the hours of darkness when the security of the monument and the safety of visitors cannot be supervised. Please note, the site is opened and closed at the advertised hours. Similar to many of our heritage sites, access to Green and of Alia outside of opening hours can be facilitated by contacting permissions at opw.ie. So, it seems, if I'm reading this correctly, that Donegal County Council and the OPW decided to allow 24 access, in other words, the barrier at the bottom, and instead have installed this pedestrian gate. So it's not just an OPW decision, seemingly. It's also a Donegal County Council decision, which is news to me. I didn't know that, if that is the case. So they say it's a trial, but it's also to reduce costs as well and to reduce antisocial behaviour and so on and so forth. So that's the up-to-date position from the OPW as it relates to access to Green and of Alia. OK, you're very welcome back to the programme. We're joined on it by someone, I'd say they feel they're a lucky, lucky man, Malachy Doyle, who was rescued from Owey Island. He's a kayaker. Malachy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
How are you feeling?
Well, you're right. I'm incredibly fortunate. I'm feeling enormously grateful to everyone who rescued me. They were amazing. I'm feeling ridiculously lucky to have come through that unscathed, but from a few little cuts and bruises. And I'm feeling somewhat embarrassed, you know, to have caused such trouble and expense and putting others at risk, you know, for my rescue. So
our amazing rescue teams that we have try and discourage those emotions because they're in the business of saving lives, Malachy, and that's what they did in this case. I think we can all agree. So how did the day unfold for you on that day?
Yeah, it was Sunday. It was, it was a really nice day. I thought, I might take a wee trip over to Owey, which is only, you know, it's only 10 minutes over the water from Critch Island where I live. And I might go and have a little look at the caves, which I've done many times, and they're really sort of spectacular and exciting thing to do. About 1:15 I was in the water and got over to Owey, decided to go up the sort of the right hand side, which is the cave side, and to go up to the sort of the last cave and then maybe have a little look in there, depending on how it looked, and then wiggle my way back along the coast. I could see that further out at open sea, you know, was rough as it usually is. So I never really go around the back of a week. You know, I'm a fair weather kayaker. So when I got to that end cave, I went towards the opening, had a look, and I didn't like the look of the water inside. It was really swirling, and you know, because there's a side cave comes in as well. The water was just, and I didn't like the look of it. I thought, nope, not going in there. I'm going back. I went to turn around, and as I was sort of broadside to the cave, you know, so sideways, this massive wave came out of nowhere because it had been really calm. It just came and just hit me from behind. I didn't see it coming. It just this sort of freak wave hit. Just suddenly I was out of the boat. It just knocked me right out of the kayak, turned the kayak over. And from then on, it was, you know, it was a nightmare, really.
So you were knocked out of the kayak in the cave?
I was at the mouth of the cave, but the wave was such that it knocked me and the kayak well into the cave.
Right, okay.
And luck, you know, all sorts of luck then held that in that I held on to the kayak. Well, I didn't want to let go of it, you know, obviously. And I managed to turn it, the kayak and the paddle. I managed to turn the kayak back over. I could see it was sort of half full of water. The you know, the waves then, the sea in the cave was really rough. And I thought, I don't think I'm getting back into this kayak, you know, the way it is now. Mm. So I'm just going to hang on to it, you know, for buoyancy. Obviously, I had a life jacket as well. But, you know, so I was, and the waves was pushing me about the cave, knocking me up against rocks all the way around it. It was pretty much sheer sided, you know, as caves often are. Yeah. So I thought, oh, you know, how am I gonna get out of this? I was bashing against rocks. I'm so lucky, you know. I swallowed a bit of water, but I actually stayed calm. I don't know quite how I managed it, but it was like I was looking down at myself, thinking, no, you're gonna get out of this, Maliki. Stay calm. What do you need to do? And
but I presume in holding the kayak to you, it left you more vulnerable to the aggression of the sea, in terms of, you know, it's going to be like the inside of a washing machine in that cave at this point. You've got one hand or both hands on the kayak. It's obviously going to be more affected by the swell and the waves and the rush than you are. Did there come a point where you had to, you know, cut it loose?
Well, you're right. Yeah, I was thinking, do I let go and do I swim for it? Because after a while, I spotted one part of the cave where there was a big rock sticking up and a ledge, sort of a ledge above it. And I thought, that's where I need to get to. I was scared to let go of the kayak, you know, because I thought, I'm going to need this kayak and it's floating, so I want to float with it. And I thought, what I really hope, and the waves were knocking me one side and another side across this very big open-mouthed cave, you know, it's a big cave. And I thought, if it takes me over there, I'm going to stay with the kayak for now, because I was worried if I let go of the kayak that I'm not the strongest of swimmers. I thought, I'm not sure I'll get over to that rock, you know, I just don't well, you know. And I thought, at the moment, I'm okay. So luckily, after a good while, it took me over to those rock. And it was at that point, I grabbed the rock. I thought, right, I need both hands to make sure I hang on to this. Grabbed the rock with both hands, at which point, of course, the kayak went away from me, but it was me or the kayak. And pulled myself up, and then clambered up onto a sort of a ledge, a standing on ledge, which was about 8 foot above the water. I mean, it didn't stay 8 foot above the water because, you know, the tide was still coming up and the waves got worse and worse and worse.
So at this point now, Maliki, if you, say, for instance, had your mobile phone in a pocket or just sitting in the kayak with you, and with everything that's happened right now, you're on a ledge in a cave on this island. Realistically, your chances of recovery at that point would be really slim, because God knows if the kayak made it out of the cave where it might end up, who's to say? So it's at this point really the critical part of this story, in that you had your phone around your neck, and I've one of these as well, and they are absolutely fantastic, around your neck in a waterproof bag.
That's right.
That I think that really is the pivotal part of this entire story, other than the great bravery of those that rescued you. But without that, you wouldn't even want to think what the consequences of this could have been.
Absolutely. That's what saved me. I had fully charged it before I went out. I had it around my neck. having been 20-30 minutes in the water, I still wasn't totally sure. You know, I've never tried it underwater. I got out and I thought, oh yeah, I've got my phone. Here it is. I turned it on. Well, yeah, and it came on, but it looked pretty blotchy. And I thought, oh, I hope this works. And I was pressing away on it. I was basically, 999999. I just over and over 999. I couldn't even remember what the other number, emergency number was. You know, I mean, obviously I was a bit panicky, but trying to stay calm. And it kept saying 999. This it can't accept. It can't read your location, so it can't connect. And I thought, oh no, You know, surely it can connect anywhere. But I thought, well, don't give up. And I was just pressing sort of almost everything that came up on my phone in the hope that I'd get something. And then I heard a woman's voice. I said, you know, she said fire. You know, I'd obviously pressed fire, and she says the fire service or something. And I just said, I'm in trouble. I'm in a cave off OE. I've come out of my car. I've fallen out of my car. I've been in the water. I'm up on a ledge. I'm very cold, and I need rescue.
Yeah, and it's an important thing to remember too with mobile phones. In the case of an emergency, it doesn't matter what network you're on. It'll an emergency call will connect to whichever network is available. At that point, how long had you been in wet clothes on this ledge, Maliki, trying to dial 999? I mean, how long at this point had you been in that situation?
Oh, I'd probably been on the ledge. I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes maybe, so not very long there.
But long enough to know what it might have been like if you were there for another 8 or 10 hours, I would imagine.
Oh, well, I ended up there another nearly 4 hours anyway. You know, I got very, very cold, very shivery, because it took, you know, that long for them to locate me and then to be able to come in, because the sea got way so much rougher that they couldn't bring a boat in even once they knew where I was.
Oh, wow.
For a long time. And they had to wait for the tide to turn. So, but yeah, having made that call, it was just sitting there thinking, I really hope that was a real person and that they understood and that they'll pass the message on. You know, I'm just thinking, I don't want to spend a night here. You know, I understand. I know about hypothermia. I know I'm cold. I'm not in a wetsuit. Another mistake. I was in my shorts. I was very cold. I was shivering. I'm totally reliant on this message.
And it's
very
kind of
stupid. Nobody knew I was out there.
Malik. And it's kind of a complicated rescue because obviously, you know, the boat can't go in just to assess you and just sail in, take you out. The helicopter, of course, can come to the scene, and I can only imagine what it was like when you heard that going. So it's still complicated. They have to figure out how to get you out there and locate you. And that's where a bit of modern technology came into things. They sent a drone in, is that right?
That was brilliant, yeah. So about an hour from that phone call, you know, as I say, really thinking, I'm totally reliant on that work, having worked. About an hour later, I heard the chopper. And I thought, yes, you know, I had this massive noise above me. And I thought, yes, the rescue's on. And I knew the chopper wouldn't see me because, you know, I was totally invisible inside a cave and the kayak was just going round and round below me in the water. If it had floated out, it would have been easier to see where I was, you know. But I knew if the chopper was around that the Coast Guard's the lifeboat, Aaron Moore, would be on the case and that eventually, you know, I was very confident eventually they would get to me. I could tell already that the sea had got so much rougher that they were going to have massive trouble getting the boat into me for, you know, until it calmed down. So I knew I was in for a bit of a long haul, but I was pretty calm once I heard the chopper. And then it was another hour then, actually, before I heard a loud hailer, because they were searching all over the place, you know. Even though I'd said OE, there was no sign of me on OE, and they had nobody gone in the cave because they couldn't. And I'm not sure. Maybe the word cave didn't come through to them. I'm not sure. But they were all over. You know, the chopper was flying everywhere. everybody in Donegal knew it was out, and the boats were all over the place. You know, I mean, Bunbeg was out, Mulroy was out, Aaron Moore was out there. It was and Rescue 118. It was incredible, you know, the brilliant service, you know, that they all put together.
They do amazing work. But, so eventually, the conditions settled to a point where one of the smaller boats could come in. You got into that boat. Well,
what happened, actually? Yeah, what happened was Oscar Duffy, who's a local man, him and some friends were out in a couple of ribs, and they know that area really well. They know the caves. They were going up and down the caves. They'd done it a few times, and they thought, we'll take one last look at that top cave. They put the loudhailer on, and I heard the loudhailer. I didn't hear what it said, but I heard it, and I just yelled. I just yelled, yes, like that, really loud, over and over, to make sure they heard me. And that was it. You know, they went and then told the RNLI the boat was coming back from Gola, I think, at that point. And they said, he's in here. And then it took another hour and a half or something before sea conditions were enough that Aaron Moore could put in what they call the little Y boat, a little two-man inflatable, because anything bigger wouldn't have got in safely. And even that one, I mean, those guys were heroes, JJ and Evan O'Donnell, I think they were called, yeah.
Well, finally, we're out of time almost. It's just a remarkable story. You got rescued. They took you in the helicopter, flew in 7 minutes, believe it or not, and you got monitored. You're home and you feel good now. And I think it's just a big thanks to everybody that was involved in that rescue. They are amazing people, aren't they, Malachy?
Absolutely. Massive gratitude to everyone involved. And a big, big warning. You know, that's why I'm happy to spread the word, even though I'm embarrassed to have caused so much trouble. You know, I really want to spread the word. Take care at sea. Tell people you're going out. Don't go out alone. You know, all those things. You know, a lot of things I didn't do right, but bring a phone with you, which I did do right. And try and stay calm. Absolutely, the rescue services were phenomenal. Phenomenal. They saved my life.
And that phone saved your life. Brilliant. Malachy, thank you so much. Yeah. And those zip bags are handy got and essential for anyone out in a kayak or any out in sea
just
at all.
A few
at all.
Euro with that.
All right, yep, take care, yep. Malachy. Glad to hear that you're well. Thank you so much. Malachy Doyle there, who was rescued from that cave at Owy Island. It is the 9 till noon show. We're going to be out on the road as part of Love Donegal, hooking up with Kevin Fury. That and so much more besides after the news at 10.